The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are available on iTunes. We are always on Stitcher. We're now on Amazon. And however you consume your podcasts, we're under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. We're on Twitter. I'm going to get better about Twitter. I haven't been great, but we are on Twitter. You can follow me at Marie Stone and Writers on Writing, KUCI-FM. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking this year. I'm spending the hour with National Book Award finalist Rahman Alam, talking about his somewhat disturbing, somewhat prophetic novel, Leave the World Behind. I should mention that this interview is being pre-recorded on Friday, October 30th. We're a couple of days away from the election. We are entering the winter season with spikes of COVID across our country. I think it's fair to say we are a nation on edge today. So whenever you happen to be listening to the podcast, it's worthwhile to note when the conversation is taking place. And more interestingly, when the book was written in relation to when it was released. We're going to get into all of that, I'm sure. Rahman Alam is the author of the novels Rich and Pretty and That Kind of Mother. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, The New Republic, New York Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, Book Forum, The New Yorker, and elsewhere. He studied at Oberlin College and lives in Brooklyn. Leave the World Behind is his latest. It is a finalist for the National Book Award. It's being turned into a movie set to star Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington. It is published by Echo, and it will drive our chat this morning. Rahman, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Marie.
Well, thanks for coming on. So I would love to hear, before we dive into the book, and there's a lot to dive into, I'd love to sort of hear about your path to becoming a writer and kind of, you know, what your life looked like growing up, like if you were surrounded by books and supportive parents who knew you wanted to be a writer, that was always the plan, or sort of, you know, how it all came about originally.
That is a really good question. It was always the plan. I was one of those kids who learned to read at the age of four and basically have not stopped in the 39 years since then. So I think I always understood writing as deeply connected to reading, this thing that I was so passionate about. And, you know, my mother's a physician, my father's an architect. So I had very educated parents, but those are sort of sciences, right? Like those are professions. And growing up, they didn't know people who were writers. They didn't know that it was a way you could make a living. But I do think that they really indulged me in this particular fantasy of you'll be a writer. I'll be a writer someday. I'll be a writer someday. When I went off to Oberlin College, I did study creative writing. I'm not really sure how my parents felt about that. I'm sure there must have been some part of them that worried over that particular choice. But I don't have what it takes to have been pre-med or to have been pre-law. You know, I've never been that person. And I've always been deeply committed to this particular pursuit. So I did study creative writing at Oberlin College. I worked with a professor named Dan Shaun, who's an extraordinary writer of fiction. And that was such a great experience. My intention thereafter was to apply that skill set to working in journalism, in magazines specifically, which I cared deeply about. So I moved to New York and I worked in publishing. I never did get my MFA, but that particular period, so I finished college in 1999. So from 1999 really on until I had my first son in 2009, I was writing. I wasn't necessarily publishing and I wasn't writing novels, but I was writing short stories. I was still reading a ton. I was really trying to figure out how to make this passion for writing and reading into my life, because I had found that journalism is a great pursuit for sure, but was not able to kind of scratch that itch, so to speak, for me. And at some point, I usually say, and I think this is true, this point came when my older son was a toddler. I was having a play date with a friend from college who was also a novelist, Emma Straub. Mm-hmm. And she said something to me that was so powerful, really an off-the-cuff remark, but really a powerful one. She said to me, you know, no one's ever going to invite you to write a novel. And she knew that I had been writing short stories. I had been publishing a few in some of the small literary magazines. But I think she was saying to me, you can recalibrate your career, but the way to do it maybe is to attempt a novel. And that really stuck with me. And I think that was really good advice. And so a little while after that, I did sit down. I had this particular hiatus at my job. I was an editor at New York Magazine at the time. So I had like a 12-week hiatus from work, and I committed to what could have been a suicide mission, which was writing a draft of a novel in 12 weeks, but I pulled it off. I wrote a terrible first draft of what became my first novel, but I finished it. What had eluded me, I think, until that point, and so this was in 2015, so I was, 38 years old, is that right? So I think what had eluded me prior to that moment was the discipline and the commitment to the long form. And that's not to suggest that the short story doesn't also demand discipline and commitment, but I think I just, it was easier to dip in and out of a short story, to write one short story a year and maybe publish it a year later in a small magazine and feel like I was making some progress. But this was a different kind of endeavor. And I'm really glad that I attempted that, because it showed me that I could do it. And I had a lot of doubt. I think no writer listening is going to not know what I'm talking about, that particular feeling of self-doubt. You know, I mean, I mentioned before I don't have an MFA. A big part of the reason I don't have an MFA is because I was so scared that I would never get into an MFA program, that I simply never applied. And that's not a good reason. That's not a good excuse, but that is the reason. I never applied to Iowa, even though I saw so many of my friends and colleagues go off in that direction. In the end, I don't regret the way that I chose to make a career. I mean, it's sort of fruitless to regret that, I suppose. But yeah, the discipline, I think, to actually write really eluded me until my adulthood.
Well, I always enjoy talking to writers who don't have their MFA to see sort of how they trained themselves and what they found useful along the way to, you know, to deliver themselves the education that they needed to write a novel. And so it sounds like it was a lot of reading and
absolutely, yeah.
A lot of, I hate to say that people cut their teeth on the short story, because it's its own form and it's very hard. But tell me a little bit about what you feel like the sort of best things you did to train yourself.
Sure, sure. I share your sense that it's incorrect to talk about the short story as an apprentice form, because it is its own endeavor. And so many of our greatest writers are masters of that particular form, right? Alice Munro won the Nobel Prize for her accomplishment with that particular form. Like she never needed to do anything bigger or better. Those were big stories. But the truth is that the undergraduate education, and indeed the MFA education, I think really relies on the short story, simply because you can accomplish it within the context of an academic semester, just by virtue of its brevity. So that was what I left college understanding, even though my senior year of college, I had been trying to write a novel. So a couple of years into working in magazine publishing in New York, I rekindled a desire to be working and not wanting to apply to MFA programs. I simply assigned myself a curriculum of short story collection reading. And so it's as basic as proceeding through the alphabet. I read a book by Alice Adams. I read a book by Ann Beatty. I read a book by Raymond Carver, and I proceeded through the alphabet. I think I got to the letter N, but I can't remember.
I love this. Great.
And because I knew that that was something I could do for myself, that I couldn't maybe conjure a workshop with 11 other writers working at the peak of their particular powers, but I could do that. I could at least be reading and learning, and you could do a lot worse than Alice Adams and Ann Beatty as models. And so I found that really useful, and I did write quite a few short stories in that period of time, and I did publish probably 5 or 6 of them between 2003 and 2011. So I was engaged in this business. I was as engaged as many writers are, and it felt really like I was doing something. But the novel is a commercial form, a commercially viable form, and writing the novel did allow me to make some money, which is important, yes. Especially because I wasn't able to teach because I don't have an MFA. So nobody would have wanted me to teach. And so I was in this curious position of making a living by writing for magazines. but also having my dream job or my weekend pursuit be more writing. And so there's kind of a fatigue that sets in where you're writing all the time in these two different registers, and neither one is easy to do. And to commit myself to making a go of it as a journalist would have been one commitment. And in the end, the desire to work in fiction won out. Like, that's really where I wanted to be. And the lever that I used to get there was the novel itself.
Well, and it doesn't seem like you've had to sacrifice the nonfiction. I mean, you certainly have published plenty in that form as well, which is nice.
I have. I will say, though, that I do think publishing the novel helped legitimize my pursuit of writing criticism or nonfiction journalism about, I always hesitate to use the word journalism because I feel like that's reserved for people who are doing important work about politics or science, but to do, you know, more engaged reporting and writing about books, which is something that I love to do because I am a reader. And so I find that deeply fulfilling, but I'm very aware of the fact that a lot of the opportunities that have come my way to do more rigorous criticism, to do deeper pieces about books, have come my way by virtue of my work as a novelist, really.
Well, let's turn towards this amazing novel. It is funny. So I read much of the novel during a power outage, which was its own weird thing. And while we're sitting on the eve of this election. And interestingly enough, the book wasn't written during any of this. It was probably written, I'm sure it was written pre-pandemic. So you were
That's a much more optimistic
time of life. But I'll let you kind of set the stage, you know, take us into a little bit, and then we can dive off from there to talk a little bit more.
So it's very difficult really to give like the stump speech about this book because I don't necessarily believe in spoilers when it pertains to a book, right? Like, knowing Emma Bovary's fate doesn't really change the experience of reading Madame Bovary. But there is a particular experience that I want the reader of this book to have. And telling her too much about what she's going to go through undermines some of the labor of the book. So I'm sort of a hypocrite when it comes to talking about this book itself. So usually what I say is the novel begins as a story of a sort of striving middle-class white family from a lovely part of Brooklyn going out to a kind of quiet, unfashionable part of Long Island for a week-long summer holiday. We meet them when they're in the car. It's a mother and father, Amanda and Clay. Amanda works in advertising. Clay works as an academic. They have two teenagers, Archie, who is 16, and Rose, who is 13. And I think the book, or I hope the book, I should say, makes you feel at first that this is a family novel, that it's a story of, this is a great convention of the literature, right? Like, a family goes to a different geography and secrets are laid bare, or they reckon with the past or whatever. And so I think that the book sort of sets you up for that. They go to this beautiful house that they've rented via Airbnb. And on the second night of their stay, there's a knock at the door, which is another kind of convention, right? The knock at the door late at night in an unfamiliar place where you're not expecting anybody and you don't know anyone introduces a trope from horror. Even if you don't know horror as a reader, you know, this is so part of the culture, you know these tropes from narrative, from film, from television, whatever. So Amanda and Clay open the door and there's an older Black couple standing there, and they tell them that this is their house and that they've come there because there has been a blackout in New York City. So at that point, what has been for the first maybe fifth of the book, a family story about well-heeled people on holiday becomes a story about this confrontation with strangers and an inability to really know for sure what's happening outside of the walls of this house. It goes pretty far from there. I think it sort of, hopefully you have a feeling that this might become a comedy of manners about race, that it could become a story about crime. The reader, I hope, feels like, okay, the book's terms have changed and now I need to reorient myself. And then the book, I hope, shifts under your feet a couple of more times to become something much bigger than what it seemed on the first page. That's my hope anyway.
And was that your experience as writer, that it started for you as one thing and then it shifted for you and then it shifted again, or you knew exactly where it was going the whole time?
I knew. Okay. I intended. Okay. So the gambit of this book, and I think an audience of writers will appreciate this particular way of thinking about it, is, I mentioned Alice Munro earlier. Alice Munro's work, as the work of so many writers, is often talked about as domestic, suggesting that its principal concern is the life of the family. I hear in that word a diminishment, like a sense of the miniature. And that's something that has always felt really wrong to me, because I think family life provides a sort of an emotional on-ramp for many, many readers of many great books. And there are many great, big, very serious books that are fundamentally family stories. The example I always use is Jonathan Franzen's Freedom and Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections. When you look at the language, the critical language deployed about those books, it's usually the social novel. So what's the difference between the domestic and the social? It seems to me, as a critic, that it's the sex of the writer, which is quite wrong to me. Jonathan Franzen, this isn't to suggest that Franzen is not a superb domestic novelist. I think he is. It's simply to suggest that that language of domesticity is not simply the purview of women and is not something that is small and uninteresting. I think it's something that's fascinating and really massive. And that was the explicit goal of this book, was to take something, in this particular book, it's sort of a literalized domesticity because the book is so interested in the house in which the people find themselves, but push through that and find everything in the culture, find our politics, our attitudes toward race, our attitudes toward art, our understanding of everything, all refracted through the life of the family and the home.
That's what I was going to say that I marveled at, is that the book is not long. It's 241 pages and the chapters are short. And the time period in which the events take place is only like 3 or 4 days. I mean, it's very compressed.
Yeah.
And the space in which it takes place is pretty much within this house, also very compressed. So you take this very compressed period of time, very compressed period of space, very compressed period of pages, and within that, explore technology and race and class and gender and climate change and geopolitical tensions. And it's marvelous. I mean, you know, it's just so much. It's kind of maybe a testament to all of the years that you practice the short story form, because that's the job of the short story, is to get so much into relatively, you know, a compressed period of space.
Yeah.
And of course, this has the scope and feeling of a novel, but it really, as you say, this idea that the domestic, there's some sort of sense of it being small. Mm-hmm. And this demonstrates how big and encompassing, you know, all of these ideas can be in a domestic sphere, I suppose.
I'm so happy to hear that you agree, or you're saying that I've accomplished that particular goal, because I do think that the domestic can hold a lot. Not that it always has to, but I mean, again, to go back to Alice Munro, what the marketing copy of those books might do is talk about those stories as the quiet lives of women in Canada. And that's absolutely true. But those are stories about the long shadow of the war, right? They're stories about people, tiny lives dealing with the forces of history. And that's their accomplishment. And the thing that Munro is always sort of praised for is the passage of time, that within 11 pages, she can cover 50 years, and she just does it so confidently. And and that's right. And it's astonishing that she is able to do that. But, you know, we misunderstand the relationship between big and important a lot in this culture. And, you know, just because a story is short doesn't mean it is not big. I've been teaching a short story class this semester at Columbia, which has been really lovely to think about the short story as a form, as an educator. And I taught Laurie Moore's Birds of America, which is one of my favorite books. And I became sort of like a ranting lunatic in front of my students about a story that she has called Dance in America, which I think is probably one of the best short stories, certainly of the last century. It is a truly astonishing piece of work. And it is so very, very small. I think it's 7 pages long. And to deal with mortality and art itself, and like come up with some kind of thing to say about these very big subjects in the space of 7 pages, you have to be a genius.
Yeah.
You really do.
My guest this morning is Ruman Alam. The book is Leave the World Behind. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Well, so much of this, as you said, centers around the house. And 2 points on that. One, I think this was based on a house that you vacationed at. So you had a mental model in mind.
I did indeed. Yeah.
Okay. And were you writing this while living in someone else's house or in someone else's apartment?
So the initial idea came from a particular yearning I had for this house. So my family had this really charmed vacation in 2017 in this lovely house on Long Island. And then that December, I was staying as a guest of the writer Laura Lippman at her home on the Upper West Side of New York City. It's quite close to the Hudson. It was December. It was absolutely freezing cold. And I was wistful for this warm summer vacation. So it's just as simple as that. Like that desire to go back in time, go back to that particular place, really stuck in my head. And I remember thinking like, oh, I should write about that vacation, but what can I do? What can I do with that vacation? I have no interest in writing a fiction that is really close to my own life. But there was something about that house that felt really right. It had cast a particular spell on me. And it's really hard for me to pinpoint the moment at which like the germ of an idea becomes an idea, right? Because it's a process of accretion, like sand becoming a pearl. It takes a long time and there are multiple points of influence and there are multiple things. So it's not just the house. It's also the desire I've already stated about doing something with domesticity in particular. There was some kind of desire to write about climate change specifically and figuring out what the metaphor was for that, for approaching such a big thing. So all these different strands have to come together and it takes time. It sort of sits in my, like a back drawer in my brain for a while. And then at some point the idea coalesces. And for me, that point usually has to do not with place and not with character really, but with voice, with the voice of the book itself or the sound of the sentences itself. And so at some point, the sound of this book was revealed to me. And I think it has a very particular sound, especially in contrast with my previous two books. It just sounds a certain way. There's a kind of authority to the narrative that I cracked, and then understanding the plot followed.
Well, that we should say that the book is told in sort of this omniscient point of view. So there are, you know, by the middle of the book, there are six primary characters, and the voice really hovers, you know, it's almost like this firefly that falls down into each one of their minds and then, you know, alights and falls again. Yeah, I really enjoyed that omniscient point of view. It's hard to tackle because you're in and out of people's minds and experiences, but you never get lost. And it sounds like that was there pretty early on.
Well, it's funny because that was the part that revealed itself to me in the middle of drafting it, when this is sort of an excellent lesson in working with an editor you trust. When my editor said to me, the reader has to understand what the characters do not, because the characters are going through this period of not knowing what's happening in the world, and the reader is right there with them for much of it. And it's at a certain point, it's simply frustrating. It exhausts the reader's goodwill because the reader demands an answer. The characters are demanding answers, but they can't have access to them, but the reader must. And so when my editor said this to me, I understood like, oh, the only way to do that is for the book to talk directly to the reader. And so on the subsequent draft, the book began speaking directly to us, and that really helped a great deal. And it's funny because it's such an old-fashioned way of writing. It's actually really out of fashion, I think. I think the dominant mode for most of my peers right now is a very close third-person perspective, where the she almost feels like an I, because the she is describing the taste of an ice cream or the motivation for a certain act, but it's still held with the distance of a third person. Right. But what this book does is it dips right inside of that equally for all of the people. So it can tell you what they are doing and what they are thinking, but it also does it for the world itself. And it can tell you what the trees are thinking. It suggests a kind of intelligence among the trees at one point. It can tell you what certain animals are thinking. It can tell you what's happening across the world. It can tell you that the characters might think one thing, but they're wrong. It's really liberating, actually. It feels kind of Dickensian almost when I first tried to do it, because it was so old-fashioned, but I really loved writing in that particular mode.
I hadn't even thought of it as old-fashioned, but you're right. I mean, now that I'm thinking back on older works, you're right. It is an older-fashioned voice. It's funny, the passages that I was highlighting were probably those where you were speaking directly to the reader, because I was like, here's a clue. Now.
Yeah.
Now we get insight into what's really happening. And so that was, it sounds like that came about in the revision process.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's when the book really came to life. So when I speak of the particular sound of the book, I'm not even really talking about the perspective. I'm talking more just about the diction and the, like, the details and what the book is enumerating and seeing. And there's a kind of chill, I think, or I hope anyway, to the voice of the book, especially at the beginning of the book. I think the voice softens once the homeowners, George and Ruth, do knock on the door. But for those first 30 pages, it feels very crisp and feels very almost, I don't even really know what the word is, but there's a crispness and a kind of sense of menace in some of the word choice that I really loved doing. And that seems like a choice apart from the perspective stuff. But as anyone who is a writer will understand, the drafts all blur together. And I would have to really sit down and like look back at draft one versus draft 11 to understand at what point certain things clarified for me.
It was funny to go back after the book was done to reread page one, because I'm always interested in, you know, page one has to do so much work, yeah. Right? I mean, it has to set the tone, it has to introduce you the right way, but it also has to lay crumbs for what's to come. And so it's always fun to go back and review those. And this was so masterfully done. It was, as you say, it was this like hyper colorized, you know, there was your use of the weather throughout this book was so wonderful because you're contrasting the sinister with the, it's a sunny day and nothing bad happens on a sunny day.
Yeah.
And so, so many of those choices that you made on page one paid dividends throughout the rest of it.
I'm thrilled to hear that. The particular choice that I am like selfishly very fond of is the first word of the book is well.
Well,
it's this qualifying well. So it's a suggestion that like the idyllic scene on which we open, which is a family in a, like a nice car driving on a beautiful day out to Long Island, that well from the very first beat of the book establishes a sense of uncertainty. That I don't know how conscious the reader is of that happening, but I think it's there. I think there's like a pebble in your shoe from the very beginning, and you just can't quite figure out why that's there, but it's, I think it begins in that one word.
I totally agree. And then when the sun is described as something like dependable, or, you know, it's always going to be there.
Yeah.
We are meant to know something is not going to be the way.
Yes,
I think so. Upon it to be. And the car described as a bell jar, you know, just so many of those.
Yeah.
I really loved this exploration of living in the homes of others, because that's a relatively new phenomenon for our generation. My family was one of the very earliest adopters of the home exchange. So we would swap houses with families for 10, I think we did this 10 times. And then Airbnb came about. And so this idea of the very intimate, the very private, the sleeping in somebody else's bed, in this book, having sex in somebody else's bed while they're, you know, while they're in the house with you. There's something very boundary breaking and interesting about that, that I think is unique to this generation. I feel like we didn't do that before.
I think you're right. I want to believe, and I don't think it is, but I like to pretend this is the first, or this is like the great Airbnb novel. Right,
yes,
that it captures that particular weirdness of inhabiting someone else's space, of touching someone else's things. And I think part of that weirdness, and the book catalogs a lot of material possession inside of its pages. And part of that is because those are the terms of the culture. Our things are the story of who we are. They're very private, they're very personal. But they're also very public, and they're like this sort of public performance of our beliefs, our ideology, our politics. And so the things you, like, I describe the house, which is a nice house, and it belongs to people who are quite wealthy. I describe them as having Pottery Barn sheets. And I think that holds so much because they could afford more expensive sheets. But there's a practicality to these people, as evidenced by the fact that they are actually renting this home, even though they don't need to. They're renting it out to supplement or to subsidize the amount they've paid to renovate the house, right? So that instead of buying, you know, Frette sheets, they've bought Pottery Barn sheets. I feel like that holds so much. And that's all stuff that the reader, you know, you either notice or you don't, or it tells you something or it doesn't. I describe Amanda, who's renting the house, as buying those recycled paper coffee filters that I buy. And they're called If You Care, which I think is like the funniest brand name in the world. But it tells you something about her politics and her sense of herself as a dutiful consumer connected to the virtue of caring, even though she's just buying things.
I should interject this here because I think it's a great writerly tip if you're stuck, and this book is so magnificent at doing it, which is the art of making lists.
Mm.
And this book has so many lists, and they're used so effectively to describe who these people are, as you say, what they value, what they want to see themselves as, you know, how their choices reflecting who they are. And so there's a really great scene at the very beginning where Amanda is going grocery shopping, and it's a long list of all of her choices that are all revealing. And in each one, sort of, as you say, with this coffee filter, with kind of a little commentary on why she's making this choice. And I think A, that served the novel so well, but B, I think it's also a good reminder to writers of this is a way you can get unstuck. Make a list of what this person has in their closet or in their liquor cabinet or in their refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you had, it felt like you had fun with that, or it felt
Oh yeah. I loved doing that. And in fact, I find it so much more rewarding than describing what she looks like. I never really describe anyone's physical appearance. I don't think in any of my books, because I'm not good at it. And it means very little to me. I think in part because everyone kind of looks the same to me. I'm sort of face blind. And so it's not of interest to me describing their physical look. So describing the objects around them is just a way of getting at exposition and character through the back door, through the side door. And lists also, I think, can have a musicality to them. Like that chapter where she's at the grocery store, it just says she bought, she bought, she bought, she bought over and over and over again. And then some of the sentences get really long and rhythmic, and some of them are really abrupt and tight. And there's an attention to a sense of menace. For example, it describes her buying those carrots that are tumbled about so that the size of a child's fingers, which is an accurate way of describing those prepackaged baby carrots, but also suggests something kind of horrifying, which I think suits what develops later in the book. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. And I think that it's great when you get to that moment in a work where you're not slogging, but you're actually having a good time.
So in terms of, as you say, the characters' appearances aren't as important to you as kind of who they are, what they value. I was wondering if you obviously had a very clear image of the house in your mind because it was a house you had stayed in. And I was wondering, it sounds like you do not keep character photos.
I don't. I think that the name holds a lot because I try to choose names that feel statistically likely. Hmm. So the Social Security Administration keeps a list of popular names by birth year, which is a really useful tool. So a woman who is Amanda's age, who is meant to be kind of an average sort of person, there's a statistical likelihood that she would be named Amanda or Jennifer or Heather or Rebecca. And it's less likely that she would be named Meadow or Hazel. A woman of Ruth's age, I think it makes a lot of sense that her name would be Ruth. It has this sort of beautiful Old Testament solidity to it. So, and then with respect to the children in this book who are more nebulous presences as characters, their names, Archie and Rose, felt really right to me as somebody who is myself raising children in contemporary Brooklyn. Like I could imagine my kids having a friend with a big brother named Archie or a big sister named Rose.
I love that. I love these tricks. Somebody said they really rely on humans of New York for their sort of imagery of people. And this, I love this idea of using the census for character names. Character names are tricky and they're very important, I think. I mean, it tells you a lot.
Yes, I think so too. And I think I should also probably credit my editor for this because she's very attuned to that. And in my previous book, I forget what name I had chosen that felt wrong to her, but she just said nobody this age would have that name. And it's a great note. I mean, that's impossible to say, of course, like in every generation, there is somebody named Diana or whatever, but I take her point that if you're aiming for a kind of sense of realism, then it's useful to ground yourself in reality and to use these tools that are actually just out there and waiting for you to use them.
So the couple that comes to the door, the owners of the house, it's a black couple. I was wondering if they were always going to be a black couple. And I only asked that because the subtext that kind of ripples through this, they're all New Yorkers. They've all lived through 9/11. There's kind of this PTSD stress around 9/11 that ripples through what they're fearing has gone on in the city. And so I was wondering if you had ever played around with the couple being a different race that might have triggered Amanda and Clay in different ways, or if they were always going to be black.
I did always want them to be black, although it would have been interesting to see how they would have responded to the arrival of an Arab couple. There's a way in which the particular binary of black and white really defines the conversation around race in this country, which is not to suggest that it's not deeply important to think about how this country talks to its people of Latinx descent or of Arab descent or of Asian descent. Like, this is a big country full of lots of different kinds of people. There's a particular thing about the negotiation between blackness and whiteness. And I also really wanted for the reader to think they knew what was going to happen. And I think that the introduction of the arrival of the people who are unexpectedly black is the deployment of a trope that will feel recognizable to the reader. So the reader knows, even if they've never seen Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, the reader understands that that's what's being deployed. Even if they've never seen Get Out, which is a sort of postmodern reimagination of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, the reader has that sitting in her cultural frame of reference as well. 6 degrees of separation, which I think I mentioned in the book, also comes up. So there's a way in which these just are triggers for the reader. I do think the book is interested in looking at race, but I also think it's interested in deploying it as not a red herring exactly, because I don't think of it as being a trick, but there's a suggestion that it's not the important conversation to be having.
Which is why I hate even asking you the following question. I'm already going to apologize for it because I know you've been asked this variations ad nauseum, but I feel, you know, the listeners will be curious. Most of the time, this question is framed around some sort of responsibility or obligation you might feel as a writer of color writing about characters of color. But what I think is kind of more interesting is, you know, at first I was thinking, who needs another book about a bunch of white rich people? mm-hmm. And then I thought, maybe that's exactly what we need, because maybe that's how this country's gotten so freaking screwed up, is mm-hmm. that this is kind of how we've caused many of our problems. And then I thought, maybe writing from your perspective is a little bit like writing from a place where you have to leave the place in order to see the place clearly. You know, mm-hmm. I talked mm-hmm. to a lot of writers who write about their childhood home, but they had to leave the home to see mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And then I was wondering if you are not actually the perfect person to tell us about the experience of, you know, this experience of whiteness and race and confronting our own internal. Anyway.
Maybe. I mean,
I don't know. I keep talking.
Who's a better student of whiteness than people who are not white?
Right.
That's the dominant language of all cultural product. Not to suggest that there's not like a vibrant culture of blackness, or, you know, what it is to be Latinx, especially in this country. Like, there is, but those are truly subcultures. The mode of the popular imagination is white. And so that is what writers of color know very well. They're schooled in it. That's what you read. It's what you study. It's what you watch on television. You project yourself into it and you understand it better than white people do, I think. Anita Bruckner, who is one of my favorite writers, she was the daughter of Jewish immigrants, I believe, from Germany or Poland to England, and is like one of the best chroniclers of English life between, you know, 1970 and the 1980s. Truly an extraordinary observer of English mores. And I think that that particular place of being the child of people from outside a place who has to learn the rules of a place, not just for yourself, but for your parents. Mm-hmm. It's a really useful place to be situated. And I am the most American person you could imagine. I was born in 1977 in this country. This is all I have ever known, but there's a hyper awareness about it because I think without knowing it, of course, I was conscious of my own difference and conscious of my parents' difference and sort of my immersion in Americanness was in part to kind of mitigate my own parents' stubborn foreignness that they could never shed despite having been here since 1973, because they came here as adults. They were already grown up. And so not just as like a product of this culture, but also as a reader of this culture, like this is all I've read. Like, we don't need another book about well-heeled white people, but those are the only books I really ever read. Mm-hmm. And so I understand the conventions of that form intimately. And there's a conversation around this particular book with respect to genre. Is it a novel of horror? Is it a thriller? To me, the genre that I am playing with the most is actually the genre that is literary fiction, which people love to pretend is not a genre, but is.
Mm-hmm.
It is playing with all of those conventions, marriage, the relationship between a parent and a child, personal, professional ambition. All of this stuff is just, these are the conventions of the middle-class novel. You know, real estate is a big one. So I know these things very well as a reader, and I understood how to like build that particular trap, I think.
My guest this morning is Ruman Alam. The book is Leave the World Behind. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Well, I think this conversation is so interesting because over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, 5 years on the show, we've talked so much about the dangers of cultural appropriation and what authority white writers have to write about experiences that are not their own. But generally, when we have that conversation, those writers haven't really been inhabiting other cultures. They've been inhabiting U.S. culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is a really interesting way to talk about it, where you've not only grown up and, you know, this is your culture, but you've had this really unique way of almost having to translate it through the generations of your parents' experience.
Yeah.
I'm probably miscategorizing that, but I think different.
That's yeah. Right. And I think it also has to do with power.
Right.
Right. That like a Black writer attempting to write about whiteness, inherently, it's a very different power dynamic than a white writer attempting to write about Blackness. And it simply is. And I don't make the rules. And also, that doesn't mean that a white writer can't try, right? You can do anything. I truly, like art, there's no rule. You can do anything. You might fail, though. And there's no way to know whether or not you failed. Like, the judgment is in the hands of the reader.
Right.
And I think the reader can tell if something is a good faith exercise or not. I think the reader can sniff that out. That's just the particular risk. And I think this particular fear of cultural appropriation, the conversation around cultural appropriation, is tricky because I think it's actually, I worry that it is scared writers off from attempting something that should be scary to them, you know, that by trying something bigger. I wonder sometimes whether the vogue for autofiction isn't born out of a fear of engaging deeply with a culture that writers feel they cannot actually possess by moral right. And so rather than turning out into the world, especially for the last handful of years, the dominant mode seems to have been to turn in to mm-hmm. the self, because no one can say you don't have the moral right to interrogate the self. I find some of those books really interesting. I find some of them less so. There's no limit, there's no formula, there's no way in which it's done well or done unwell. But I do worry about the particular rigor of thinking about cultural appropriation or writing across difference as like a hard and fast set of rules rather than something that you need to think about morally.
It's funny. I mean, this is off topic, but after Station 11 came out in 2014, I saw Emily St. John Mandel speak about it, and she was talking about how we're all invested in believing that we're living through the end of times, that that's just mm-hmm. a generational necessity. Mm-hmm. That really kind of does feel like we're actually living through the end of times. And the book was obviously written at a time when we weren't so much feeling like we were mm-hmm. living through the end of times. And I was wondering if your experience of the book, now that it's out in the world and is where it is and we are where we are, if you're experiencing the book different than you experienced it when you were writing it.
It was, so it's funny to think about Station 11, which is, I think, from 2015?
14 or 15, yeah.
14 right. or 15.
Yeah.
And then you think about, I don't know if you read Oryx and Crake and the two subsequent novels that Margaret Atwood wrote that are connected to that original work, which are older still than Station 11, or, you know, just this year, Jenny Offal's Weather, which is an extraordinary book, and Lydia Millett's A Children's Bible, another extraordinary book. These are all works that are looking at the same issues. They're all looking at the sense that maybe time is out of step, or that we are at the end of history, or that there's something sort of uncanny and broken about reality itself. Not in the way that I think the Republican Party wants you to think, like, not that reality is a subjective measure, but that everything is a little off kilter, everything is a little off the rails. And so that Emily St. John Mandel was thinking about this in 2015 suggests to me, or whenever she actually wrote that book, because that's when it was, if that was when it was published, it suggests to me that this feeling has been with us for a while. And I think we have a very short cultural memory. And you mentioned 9/11, which does loom over the events of this book. I don't know if this particular break or rupture is attributable to 9/11. I don't know if it comes with man walking on the moon. Like, I don't know. I really don't know. But in this book, when I talk about state violence against Black Americans, which I do quite explicitly at the start of the book, the contemporary reader is going to fill that in with George Floyd or Breonna Taylor. Or, I mean, you could, like, every day sort of gives us a new name to use in that instance. But 50 years ago, you might have as well said Emmett Till, right? So these things recur, and they've been recurring for a long time. It's almost like the song is repeating. It's not really changing. And so, yeah, this feeling of like we are at the end, maybe it always feels that way.
Her point was kind of nice, which is, you're right, it is always the end, because whatever you're living through, that world is over. You know, I mean, now we can't even imagine the world without the iPhone or Google.
Yeah. Yeah.
The world is over, and we live in a new world now. So, Did I hear that you tweeted this book to yourself as a way of tricking yourself to write it? Okay, so that's
this,
brilliant.
Yeah, this is okay. So this is like such solid advice for anyone who is just struggling with their own productivity, because I do tweet all the time, and like most of us, I have my phone with me all the time. And I was working at the time as an editor at the New York Times and commuting. And so I would tweet on my commute often, or just sort of like surf the headlines, or, you know, see what was happening in the world. And I realized that tweeting is just writing. And if I could muster the energy to tweet, I could start writing. And so I made another Twitter account that is locked. I still have it. And I started writing sentences that became the opening lines of this book that way. It wasn't an exercise I spent a lot of time on. I think I did it for like a month, but it showed me that I could immerse myself into the language of the book, which is very key for me as a starting point for a long project, and that I had simply been putting it off by telling myself I couldn't do it. I didn't have the time. I didn't have the attention. I didn't have the tool. I did have the tool. I didn't have 8 hours to sit at my computer all day, but who does really? But I did have my phone. And so I think that's really useful. I have got really adept since becoming a parent at cramming writing into these tiny pockets of the day, carrying a notebook with me, carrying my phone with me. I email myself sentences all the time. I email myself things that I'm interested in interrogating in a piece. I email myself drafts and read them on my phone. You know, I'm constantly kind of scratching away at something. And that's abetted by technology rather than, you know, impeded by technology, simply because I just chose to think of it that way. In exactly the same way that you might say, instead of driving to get the kids at school, I'll walk and then I'll get in some exercise, and then I don't have to go to the gym, and I've made my day more efficient, and I've tricked myself into getting some exercise. You know, it's not easy to show up for your work because it's work. And it's especially not easy if you're working a day job, or if you have kids or a parent to care for, or responsibilities, as all of us do. So that kind of subterfuge, you know, that sort of fake out for yourself can be really useful.
No, I just thought that was such a brilliant suggestion.
I have a lot of them. I do many of these. I mentioned before that I assigned myself this alphabetical reading list that had no particular logic to it beyond the alphabet. I often do a kind of writing exercise where I have to write a story or write something that is an arbitrary number of words. And it has to be that number of words. It cannot be more and it cannot be less. So 333 words. You have to write 333 words. Go. You know, you have to turn on an episode of Friends and turn the volume down and write until that episode is over. Because on a bad day, on a rough day where you're like folding laundry or whatever, there is a way in which you would allow yourself to sit and watch a rerun of Friends for 23 minutes. And you might not allow yourself to sit down and write for 23 minutes. So this is just a way of kind of defeating that particular instinct and saying, I'm going to do the thing that I want to be doing. I'm not going to let the world interfere with it.
So smart. And I love turning technology to good instead of evil for your writing life.
That's, I mean, it's very distracting for me too. Like, I get it. It's a very distracted time to be alive, but you've got to at least fight back a little bit.
Yeah. Right. I also love that I was reading Pet Sematary, Stephen King's Pet Sematary, from a crafty point of view, just like managing suspense and whatnot. And I thought that's also a good trick, is to go to books that necessarily wouldn't teach you something about Stephen King's style, but reading books through a particular lens to, you know, managing suspense or whatever it might be.
I think that writers of literary work can often be needlessly snobby about genre. I think that you could learn a lot by reading a book that has really connected with the readership and understanding its strategy. So you may not learn something from Leanne Moriarty about how to write a sentence. She may not teach you that the way that Saul Bellow might teach you that, but she can certainly teach you how to put a story into an irresistible form. You know, millions of readers can't be wrong. That kind of thing. You know what I mean? And I think, right. I mentioned television before. I think that the tactics of storytelling on very popular sitcoms can also be informative. A novel is not a TV show. They're two different endeavors, but there's a way in which you can learn something. And I think it's very useful to try to learn something from people who have clearly connected with an audience, as Stephen King has, as Leanne Moriarty has, as Daniel Steele has. You know, again, Daniel Steele is probably not going to teach you how to write a sentence, but you might be surprised by what she's able to teach you.
She can really teach you about writing sex, right?
Yeah. And also by discipline. You know, Daniel Steele is like, she could have retired a long time ago.
Right.
She has a lot of discipline. She's very committed to what she does. And I think there's something really instructive there. I know, because I spent, you know, the 16 years between finishing college and publishing my first novel, wishing that I had written a novel. I wish I had understood that it was in some ways as simple as committing to the deranged endeavor that it is, right, of saying, I will do it. I will find the discipline. I will find the time. We waste a lot of time in this culture. Contemporary existence is really a time suck. And forcing myself to cut out the extras and to really devote myself to that thing, to create that first manuscript. You know, I feel this way with every book that I've written. I have nothing until I have the first draft, absolutely nothing. And I have to produce the first draft, and it's awful and painful. And then once you've done it, you have those 300 pages and you hold them in your hand, and they need so much work. Like, it's agonizing, but you have done that huge first step of just producing, committing to producing those pages. And that's an incredible feeling. And I feel there's so many times during the process of revision that I feel very low. And I simply look at that accrued stack of papers and I think, well, I did it. I took it this far, so I have to actually just keep going.
Has your work changed during the pandemic, where you're, I know you have two yeah. little ones and you're yeah. trapped at home.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone's work has changed, and I think that you have to be generous with yourself about what's realistic under very unusual circumstances. So I've been teaching, which has actually been a great gift for me, because it's a distraction from the publication of this book, and it allows me to look at, you know, the stories that I'm teaching through the eyes of young readers who haven't encountered this work before. And it forces me to articulate what it is I like about this work, which is very useful as a reader and as a writer myself. And I have been reading a lot. And so the tricky thing for me is that art is always an input-output system. And I can't go to a museum right now, which is a huge part of how I repair myself between projects. I go see a lot of art. I go watch films. I can go to a concert. I live in New York City. There's so much to see and do. And none of that stuff is really happening right now, but the book hasn't gone away. And so I've been reading a lot and just trying to stay as engaged as we can when you're getting push alerts on your phone every 5 minutes about the latest polling or whatever it is.
Right. Well, you have given us so much great advice and some good reading tips. Is there anything else that we should have mentioned writing advice wise or reading advice wise? That
I mean, the really the best writing advice that I have is that there's no adjudicating committee that decides whether or not you are a writer. And it's so easy to believe that there is. Like, I think back to like that younger self who was so terrified of even applying to the Iowa Writers Workshop. Like, what was I afraid of? Like, even if you apply to a graduate school and you don't get in, like, that is not the end of your career. Like, no, there's no body sitting in judgment of saying whether or not you can do this. It's really a test of your own commitment to what it is you want to do. And my experience for me and for most of my colleagues, I think this thing is like it's a pathology. It's like a thing you can't shake. Like, it's a thing that you really have to do. And so remind yourself of that, like stay in that place where it feels like something you have to do. I think that really serves you well in the end.
That's such good advice, because I remember there was a stage where I was, you know, going to every writing teacher I could find and say, just tell me, do I have it? Do I not have it? Am I wasting my time? And I'm not, you know, that's impossible, because, you know, it's like telling a 12-year-old, you know, can you be a surgeon or not? Well,
right. I mean, exactly.
You put
exactly.
in the time, you can. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, the other thing I love to point out is that, you know, I mentioned Anita Bruckner. She published her first book when she was 53. And Norman Rush, who I think is one of the greatest living American writers, also published his first book at 53. So there's a way in which if you're too immersed in the academic system, or you're too immersed in the culture that really fetishizes youth and productivity and money and capital, you can believe that it's imperative to be 29 and great looking and a product of a sterling school and a great education, and that's how you have to begin your career. But that's really untrue. It's absolutely untrue.
And the beauty is you get better as a writer, because the more life experience you have,
oh, for sure,
the more, absolutely, you know,
yeah,
life knocks you around. Yeah, it's just going to get richer and deeper. So yeah, it's to your advantage, unlike playing football or something.
Exactly, exactly. Your career as a ballet dancer may be over by the time you're 17, but your career as a writer, I think, really gets going when you have lived a little.
Yeah. Rahman Alam, the book, Leave the World Behind. It is fabulous. So you have a website where we can
find
you?
I do. It's just my name. It's RahmanAlam.com, which is like, it rhymes, RahmanAlam.com rhymes. And I usually like try to update what I've been publishing and what I'm up to there. So.
And I know you're on Twitter.
All the
I
time.
I follow you there.
All the time.
I can find you there. This was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
That was Rahman Alam. The book, Leave the World Behind, is out and available now. It's published by Echo. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks very much for joining us. Have a great day.